The Thomistic Institute's Aquinas 101 program is bringing the truth of the Catholic faith to millions every year, but it's only possible because of support from listeners like you. Aquinas 101 is entirely audience-funded. Each episode exists thanks to your generosity. Will you help make the next one possible with a small gift? Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to learn more. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/donate.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So this is the talk on parenthood, and I wanted to just preface it with a couple of thoughts. So the first is that during the pandemic in 2020, when we were spending a lot more time with each other than we usually did, and I was spending a lot more time with my son, John, who at the time was 1.5 during the day, I was also reading Anna Karenina to prepare for an online reading group that I was helping to lead, and I noticed a couple of things. The first was that the most significant thing in my life, the thing that both gave me the greatest joy but also sort of caused me the greatest anxiety and the thing that required the most from me, was my relationship with my son. And the second thing that I realized was that I had never been invited to reflect in a serious way, in a theological or philosophical way, on that relationship. I had written papers on friendship. Graduate school, I had read books all about sexual ethics, but at no point had anyone asked me to think about what fatherhood would mean for me. And now it had become kind of the dominant force of my world. So I hope that my remarks today can be kind of a remedy for that, and that both Jane and I can help you think about what it means to be a father and a mother in a theological and a philosophical way. The other point that I want to make at the beginning is that, you know, the title of the talk is something about the vocation to parenthood. And I think that parenthood is sort of good as a shorthand. We know what it means. I think it's slightly misleading because parenthood doesn't really appear in theology and philosophy until recently. And that's because the thing that parenthood is a shorthand for is motherhood and fatherhood, which are two distinct but complementary things, right? And this is, of course, true at a biological level. The father and the mother biologically have complementary but different roles in the production of children, right? It's also true at the sociological level. If you look, go online, you can find a lot of things about how mothers and fathers provide different things for their children. Children want different things from mom, from what they want from dad. You can find lots of studies about how important it is for fathers to be in the lives of their children and all the different kind of ways in which children succeed more when dad is in their life. And those are all really good, but I don't want to get into those today, especially since many times when we talk about fatherhood, those are the things that come up. I want to focus on a couple of characteristics of fatherhood that, as you'll note, are not mutually are not sort of exclusive to fathers, right? If I say fatherhood is about generativity, it doesn't mean that women aren't the ones having the babies, right? So you should be able to kind of connect the dots, fill in the blanks, right? But I think it's helpful for me to talk about the thing that I know, which is fatherhood, for Jane to talk about sort of aspects from motherhood, where again, it's not as though all the things that Jane says aren't in some way applicable to or analogous to the, you know, men in the room and what they're going to experience. And so the first thing that I want us to think about with fatherhood is that fatherhood is about generation or begetting. And the second is that fatherhood is about priesthood. And again, I think you'll see how those connect to motherhood as well. So in the first part of the Summa, in question 33, In his treatise on the Trinity, St. Thomas considers the Father and the particular properties of the Father, i.e. what distinguishes the Father from the other persons of the Trinity. So in question 33, article 2, in the corpus of the article, St. Thomas writes, "The proper name of any person signifies that whereby the person is distinguished from all other persons. For as body and soul belong to the nature of man, so to the concept of this particular man belong this particular body and this particular soul. And by these is this particular man distinguished from all other men. Now it is paternity which distinguishes the Father, the person of the Father, from all other persons. Hence this name Father, whereby paternity is signified, is the proper name of the person of the Father." So this talk obviously isn't on Trinitarian theology, but the thing I want to underscore here is that the thing that makes God the Father is his paternity, his being a principle for, being the generator of the other persons of the Trinity. The thing that makes God the Father is that the Father is unbegotten and that the Father begets the Son and spirates the Spirit. Okay? So Aquinas goes on to argue that because the Father and the Son are ontologically one, that yes, this dynamic of begetting is there, but they are in fact one being eternally, that the Father and the Son manifest perfectly the idea of paternity and filiation. And here he's echoing especially the Latin, but also the Greek text of Ephesians 3:14-15. Right? Ephesians 3:14-15 says, "For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth takes its name." That translation is the RSV translation. So, and it's kind of similar in the NRSV. So that word family there is not familia, but in Latin, in the Vulgate, the word is paternitas, so literally fatherhood. And in Greek, the word is patria, which on the one hand means family, but on the other hand, it also means fatherhood. Right? So our share, the kind of the human share in fatherhood, is a share in God's fatherhood. And God's fatherhood is grounded in giving the other persons of the Trinity their being. And we see this, I think, as well in Genesis 1, where that fatherhood is exercised analogically in the act of creation. The great Dominican preacher Meister Eckhart writes of creation as a kind of ebullitio, like a pot bubbling over, right? So creation in some ways bubbles over out of the love of God. This eternal generation of the Son and the Spirit and the love and relationship that they share with the Father boils over into the generation of other beings that can participate in but be distinct from the divine being. So we human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and God's first words to Adam and Eve are, "Be fruitful and multiply." Now, he says this to some of the other animals too, though curiously not to all of them. I'm not sure why. We'll have to tackle that in another talk. But his first words to Adam and Eve are, "Be fruitful and multiply," and I think that that's significant. Part of our being in the image and likeness of God is our capacity for begetting new life, our capacity for generation, and our capacity for, just like in the Trinity, our capacity for generation out of a union of love. The capacity for our human love to bubble over into a new human life. So to put it another way, God made men and women to beget new life and thereby to share in his fatherhood. And I want to underscore this because I think this is an idea that I'm a convert to Catholicism. This is an idea that I came to in Catholicism that is radically different from our dominant culture. It's radically different from the vision of human beings that you marched against yesterday. And one of the clearest expressions of that vision, which I think is accurately called, in this case, the culture of death, one of the clearest images of the culture of death for me remains a poster that was on the wall of a girl who lived on my hall my senior year of college, who was very active with Planned Parenthood. And she had on her wall a poster that was kind of a rows of condoms in all the colors of the rainbow. And underneath it said, life is sexually transmitted, right? So human, on the one hand, right, that's intended as sort of a caution, right? But on the other hand, that's a very clear implication, right? Human life is or can be like an STD. In stark contrast to that, Scripture and our faith teach us that our capacity for generating new life is good, that it's a gift. It's not like a disease. Yes, it's a gift to handle with care and prudence. Scripture is full of people misusing the gift of generating new life and the terrible consequences that that can bring for families, for nations, right? But the gift of bringing about new life is not dangerous to the point of being diseased. It's part of our being like God. It's constitutive of our humanity. It's not a mistake. It's not something that we can simply thwart or unplug or ignore without consequence. And in his apostolic exhortation, Familiaris Consortio, which Jane and I have both referenced, and which, when I reread it, in preparation for this, was even better than I remembered, so I definitely commend that to you. In Familiaris Consortio, St. John Paul II writes, according to the plan, and he's quoting in this first part, Gaudium et Spes, according to the plan of God, marriage is the foundation of the wider community of the family. Since the very institution of marriage and conjugal love are ordained to the procreation and education of children in whom they find their crowning. I loved that phrase. The institution of marriage and conjugal love are ordained to children in whom they find their crowning. In its most profound reality, this is continuing JP2 here, love is essentially a gift. And conjugal love, while leading the spouses to the reciprocal knowledge which makes them one flesh, does not end with the couple because it makes them capable of the greatest possible gift. The gift by which they become cooperators with God for giving life to a new human person. Thus, the couple, while giving themselves to one another, give not just themselves, but also the reality of children, who are a living reflection of their love, a permanent sign of conjugal unity, and a living and inseparable synthesis of their being a father and mother. When they become parents, spouses receive from God the gift of a new responsibility. Their parental love is called to become for the children the visible sign of the very love of God from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named. And there JP2 is quoting that verse from Ephesians again. So I think here JP2 underscores another important aspect. This is kind of a nice bridge into that part of the talk, that I wanted to mention about priesthood. JP2 is underscoring that parents become visible signs of God's love, both for each other and for their children. So a good father shows his wife and his children what God's love looks like. And later, JP2 puts it this way, in revealing and in reliving on earth the very fatherhood of God, a man is called upon to ensure the harmonious and united development of all the members of the family. And so that brings me to the second characteristic of fatherhood, which is that fatherhood is about priesthood. And I mean this in the sense that we are all called by our baptism to participate in, and we're empowered to participate in, the priesthood of Christ. And those of us in the lay life have been called to sanctify the world through our acts of charity, and through the preaching of the gospel. And this emphasis on the vocation of the laity is, of course, one of the great contributions of the Second Vatican Council and a lot of John Paul II's pontificate, but we already see it in the Summa Contra Gentiles, where we find Thomas reflecting on how fathers and mothers are called to participate in the priestly work of Christ. So at the beginning of his discussion of the sacraments in Summa Contra Gentiles Part 4, and I think this is on your handout, Thomas writes, for some, propagate and conserve the spiritual life in an only spiritual ministry. I think it's a ministerium tantum spiritualum. And this belongs to the sacrament of holy orders. And some in a ministry, again, a ministerium that is simultaneously bodily and spiritual, which takes place in the sacrament of matrimony, whereby a man and woman come together to beget offspring and to rear them in divine worship. Now here Thomas obviously is clearly distinguishing between the work of a spiritual father and the work of a natural father and mother. But he's clearly identifying them both as a kind of ministerium, as a kind of priestly work that sanctifies the world, that offers it to God, and that brings souls to him. So one of the things I want to do is think about, okay, well, what is it? How do we think about the priesthood? What is it that priests do? How does that then apply to the life of the family and especially the life of the father? Right? So fatherhood isn't just about generating children, as Jane was saying earlier, but forming them so that their lives are directed toward the worship of God. And this is where I wanted to bring in another wonderful quote from Familiaris Consortio. So John Paul II writes, "The Christian family, too, is part of this priestly people, which is the church, by means of the sacrament of marriage, in which it is rooted and from which it draws its nourishment. The Christian family is continuously vivified by the Lord Jesus and called and engaged by him in a dialogue with God through the sacraments, through the offering of one's life, and through prayer. This is the priestly role which the Christian family can and ought to exercise in intimate communion with the whole church through the daily realities of married and family life. In this way, the Christian family is called to be sanctified and to sanctify the ecclesial community and the world." And the example of this that JP2 underlines is family prayer. He says, "The concrete example and living witness of parents is fundamental and irreplaceable in educating their children to pray. Only by praying together with their children can a father and mother, exercising their royal priesthood, penetrate the innermost depths of their children's hearts and leave an impression that the future events in their lives will not be able to efface," unquote. Those of you who know anything about the life of John Paul II, it strikes me that this is very much autobiographical for him. I cannot imagine that he's writing this without thinking of his parents, both of whom died when he was young, at different times, but still very young in his life. So let me be clear, it is messy to live out these beautiful ideas in everyday life. If you just take the idea of family prayer, our weekly family rosary involves clutching for moments of recollection between endless questions about what bead we're on, constant exhortations to stop swinging or stretching the rosary, to sit down, to behave like we're praying, etc. As Jane said, at least for boys, objects are not used according to their original intent. Everything becomes a garbage truck or a gun or a weapon or something. And so you have to kind of constantly exhort to stick to the task at hand. For reasons that are unknown to both Jane and me, I am constitutionally incapable of knowing what mystery we're on. So I'm the one who's supposed to be leading the rosary, and I'm going, "The first joyful mystery is this, and then the third sorrowful mystery is this." And Jane is like, "No, dear. The second joyful mystery." Oh, okay. So I'm sort of helping, but not entirely helping, right? And when we were discussing this with our pastor, he reminded us of a valuable maxim of both the athletic life and the spiritual life, which is a messy win is still a win. So if we give you nothing else today, like, remember that for your own parenting. So we try to take as many messy wins as we can in the hope that thereby we actually are laying a foundation of real love, a foundation of piety. That those habits are being inculcated and that that love is kind of being practiced and laid down. So one of the things that priests do, right, is they sanctify things, they bless them, they consecrate them. We've talked a bit about how that works, hopefully, in the home. Another thing that priests do, right, is that they offer sacrifice. That's something that Catholicism actually has in common with many other religions, right? And the priesthood, of being a father entails offering sacrifices constantly. The priest of being a mother does too, but I wanted to talk sort of about being a father. So there's a lot of sacrifices to offer for your wife, for the sake of your children. I threw in a quote that I like there from the journalist Jonathan Lass, who in a Weekly Standard article on being a dad writes, "The primary effect of children is to take things from you. It begins with sleep, time, and dignity, and then expands over the years to include serenity, sanity, and a great deal of money. I am making an observation here, not complaining. It's just what they do. In that way, children are like the aging process itself, an exercise in letting go of the ancillary parts of your existence until you are stripped bare, and what remains is your elemental center, your soul. I'm told Jews see something of this in the suffering servant songs in Isaiah. Christians know it as the way of the cross. A consultant from McKinsey would call it addition by subtraction." And there's, I think it's very true that the vocation of fatherhood, when lived well, is an ascetic one. As I mentioned earlier, it's one where you learn to put the needs of others before your own, to choose their good instead of your pleasure or benefit, again and again and again. And reflecting on this same theme, and in line with what we discussed St. Thomas writing about matrimony earlier, John Paul II writes, "Spouses are therefore the permanent reminder to the church of what happened on the cross. They are for one another and for the children witnesses to the salvation in which the sacrament makes them sharers." Now, if I may, let me conclude with one more thought that's perhaps more directed towards the men here. So I think there are two kinds of troubling voices out in the world, and especially online, that young men can find very attractive right now. And one of them says that family is an unjust burden. It's a commitment and a responsibility that keeps you from having fun, from living your best life, from traveling around, from hooking up with fun people, from having endless brunches, etc. Brunch definitely dies when you get married and have two children. There's no more brunches. That season of life is gone. And another, I think, kind of in reaction to this, says that real masculinity is a matter of exchanging weakness and pleasure-seeking for strength and for domination, that real men are kind of hyper-masculine. And among other things, they embrace an uncompromising and rigorous view of gender roles kind of as an antidote to the weaknesses of modernity. And I'd argue that both of these are ultimately wrong. They're kind of like the vicious extremes when we want to find a virtuous mean, right? So those of you who've studied the virtues before, you know that courage is the mean between weakness and cowardice, but also between rashness, right? The courageous person isn't kind of stupidly brave or foolishly brave, right? And I think between these two, there's a third way, right? To put it another way, those two kind of views characterize being a man as kind of a matter of either pleasure-seeking or domination. And one side says that's bad, and one side says that's good. And I think Catholicism invites us to say, actually, masculinity, being a man, strength are for service, for giving yourself away. They're for loving others, not for loving yourself, right? We are called as men to follow the Lord Jesus, who lived a life not of domination, right? Who didn't demand submission from others, but lived a life of self-sacrifice for those who he came to serve, right? Who, on the one hand, calls his followers servants, but who also calls them friends. And I think the virtuous mean between those two popular visions of being a man is the way of the cross, right? Which is a path by which you find your life in losing it, and by which you enter into joys that you didn't know existed, on the far side of bearing burdens you didn't know you could bear. And that, to me, is the path of holiness to which St. Thomas and St. John Paul II call us, the path by which Christ calls us to share in his fatherhood and his priesthood for the salvation of our own souls and the souls of our wives and children. So I want to, with some of those reflections on fatherhood, I want to turn it over to Jane. Do you share all things in common?
We do. So Nathaniel's spoken about fatherhood with a focus on God the Father, and I would like to speak about the life of a parent, particularly through the lens of the incarnation, through the work of the Son. And on this, make 2 points. First, Nathaniel and I have found that becoming parents has allowed us to enter more deeply into the mystery of the incarnation. And one especially important aspect of this for me is how the life of grace makes even the smallest acts of motherhood a participation in this mystery, and gives eternal significance to the many daily, menial, mindless, sometimes infuriating tasks of being a mom. So we're going to set this up theologically, and then I'll tell you kind of how it applies to life as a mom. In the Tertia Pars of the Summa, Thomas spends a great deal of time, more than most of his contemporaries, talking about the mysteries of Christ's life in the Gospels. And here he says something very important. Christ saves us not only by divine power, but also through the mystery of his incarnation. Christ saves us not only by divine power, but also through the mystery of his incarnation. In other words, among the many ways God could have brought about salvation, he saw fit to do it through the mysterious union of divine and human natures in Jesus, the Word made flesh. This is a crucial point for Thomas, who claims that everything Christ did and suffered in the Gospels is salvific, and these things are a manifestation of divine love. The Gospels recount Jesus praying, weeping, thirsting, sleeping, spitting in the dirt, tracing lines in the sand, and turning over tables. These are not details to be passed over as though the real message were somewhere else in the story. These are details to be lived into. What kind of God weeps? What kind of God heals, not with divine power alone, but with clay made from spit? One of Aquinas' most well-known teachings on the incarnation is that it is not necessary, but fitting. God could have brought salvation about another way, but chose this specific way. Like it is not necessary to travel from New York to Washington, D.C. in a car, but it is certainly more fitting to do so than to travel on foot. In his commentary on John, Aquinas says that one of the reasons for the incarnation is that because due to sin, humans could no longer come to know the Creator through looking at creation. And this is a passage from his commentary on John. For creatures were not sufficient to lead to a knowledge of the Creator. Hence, John, the Gospel writer, says, through him the world was made, and the world did not know him. Thus, it was necessary that the Creator himself come into the world in the flesh and be known through himself. And this is what the apostle says. Since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God by its wisdom, it pleased God to save those who believe by the foolishness of our preaching. So Christ came to save us in a manner by which we could know him. He stooped down to our level and met us through the senses. We can find this idea across the tradition in patristic and medieval sources in the East and West, Athanasius, John Chrysostom. St. Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, which Aquinas quoted above, called this the foolishness of speech or the foolishness of what was preached. And as we just saw, Aquinas cites this line from 1 Corinthians, and I think it's worth looking back a bit more of the scripture passage to get a sense of why Paul is saying this. So here's the passage from Corinthians. Paul says, "The word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe." John the Apostle, who quotes this passage in the prologue to his gospel, implies a resonance between this foolishness of preaching and the act of speaking, and the identity of Christ as the Word of the Father who became incarnate, suffered, and died, the Word of the cross. So the second person of the Trinity entered human life and language in the incarnation. The perfect God became a human and assumed human defects, like thirst and hunger. The singular, perfect word became human and spoke many words. Early Christians have compared this to the way a great rhetorician might stoop down to babble with a baby. One of my favorite images of this is when Jesus goes into the synagogue and reads from the book of Isaiah. What does it mean to go into a synagogue and to condescend to read from a text that you as word inspired? And Aquinas' predecessor, Augustine of Hippo, speaks very eloquently on this Johannine-Pauline idea. And I quote a big chunk of his work, De Doctrina Christiana, on your handout, which I recommend that you look at, but I'll just give a few highlights here. He says in that book, which Aquinas has read, "We would be incapable of knowing and enjoying the truth unless wisdom itself had seen fit to adapt itself even to such infirmity as ours, and had given to us an example of how to live, in no other mode than the human one, because we too are human. But we, of course, when we come close to wisdom, are acting wisely. So when wisdom came to us, it was thought by proud people to have acted rather foolishly. And when we come close to wisdom, we grow strong. So when wisdom came to us, it was thought to have been made weak." And you see here Augustine quoting Corinthians as well. And then paragraph 13, he says, "How did wisdom come, if not by the word becoming flesh and dwelling among us? It is something like when we talk. For what we have in mind to reach the minds of our hearers through their ears of flesh, the word which we have in our thoughts, becomes a sound and is called speech. And yet this does not mean that our thought is turned into that sound, but while remaining undiminished, it takes on the form of a spoken utterance. This is how the word of God was not changed in the least, and yet became flesh to dwell among us." So this is the kind of God we have. This is the kind of love God shows. And further, God has chosen the married state, with its predisposition toward begetting and rearing children, to be a sign of this love, this kind of foolishness of preaching. So what does that have to do with being a mom and a dad? Well, Christ's is a seemingly foolish self-emptying, in which he reveals the divine wisdom from within the messiness of human existence. And his mission, by many standards, was an embarrassment. It ended in failure, and it was definitely a waste of time. Raising children is a waste of time. If you want to get ahead in this life, don't have kids. Or if you do, make sure you time it right so there's as little sacrifice involved as possible. You should not have to compromise your career or your freedom because of your children. Approach the decision to have a child like you might approach the decision to adopt a pet. Some work and expense will be required, of course, but at the end of the day, the pet, or your child, will ultimately come into your world and fit into your vision of a comfortable and prosperous life. This is the wisdom of the world. The wisdom of Christian motherhood and fatherhood is very different, and like the Incarnation, it often confounds such worldly wisdom. Here's an example. Nathaniel and I are fairly well educated. We are the doctor's Peters. Between us, we read or speak 7 languages. We travel and give talks. He's even publishing his first book. That's impressive, right? But our kids don't care about any of this. They want Nathaniel to wrestle with them, and they want me to snuggle with them. They want us to read the same stories over and over again. As a scholar, the primary text I've been reading most of late is not anything by Thomas Aquinas. It's Little Blue Truck. And I have the whole thing memorized. Horn went beep, engine purred, friendliest sound you've ever heard. Little blue truck went down the road, beep, said blue to a big green toad. Toad said croak and winked an eye as little blue truck went rolling by. I could recite the whole thing. You know what else the kids want? They want to learn in a fun way. This has led us to making up very silly songs. Such hits as Clean Up Your Toys, Everybody Poops, and Socks for Every Occasion. Kids want to feel safe. This means they are constantly testing your boundaries and doing things that are completely unreasonable. And you find yourself saying the stupidest sounding things. Things like, you can't use your icons by the bed as coasters. We don't just eat tuna by the handful. We don't shoot people on the toilet. It's undignified. Even priests need to brush their teeth. Stop breathing into your muffin. No robot liturgical chant at the table, and my personal favorite, for the last time, do not call me bro. Parenting really is a foolishness of speech, a self-emptying, voluntary and involuntary, of the things we cling to that make us feel important and powerful. Motherhood has been a huge learning curve for me, and God has given me a lot of grace, first in slowly and gently breaking me of my deepest sinful dispositions like pride, self-loathing, and perfectionism, and then in showing me how as a mother I can love and be loved in his love. Growing up, I was not at all certain I was called to be a mom, and I was perplexed by women who asserted their desire for marriage and children so confidently. A spouse and children seemed to me to be an undeserved gift and maybe even something I wouldn't be that good at. Besides, I was a serious student who wanted to pursue an advanced degree and a bit adventurous too, and I wasn't sure how these would combine with marriage. I knew that to be married was to be fundamentally open to children, and so I refused to pursue it simply for my own satisfaction. I discerned religious life several times, and despite the deep respect I have for religious and their life, I never felt quite at home. I remember a particularly poignant moment when I attended a celebration of Nashville Dominicans who had just taken their final vows. It was beautiful. From across a reception room of floating white robes and beaming faces, I caught sight of a colorful statue of the Holy Family in the corner, gently suggesting to me, perhaps, that the beauty and sanctity of the convent could also be found in home and family. As Nathaniel and I became friends, we realized we shared a common vision of family life, and the possibility of the married vocation became more concrete. I found myself desiring to make a life and a home with this person, who complimented me in so many surprising and delightful ways. It was important that when he asked me to marry him, I'm going to skip the part where he left me standing in the rain while he prepared the surprise. He told me he wanted me to be the mother of his children. That was a great gift he gave me because he affirmed something in me that I desired but was really only beginning to see in myself and really only beginning to have the courage to desire myself. And I make this point and tell this part of the story because, like Nathaniel, I think the discernment for marriage very much was grounded in the desire for children. And that's something that our culture doesn't really communicate well. But the question for me was not, you know, do I want to be with a spouse or do I want to be in a convent? It was sort of going back to this idea of ebullitio, the boiling over. It was sort of, how do I want my love to overflow? And then more and more, I began to envision my love overflowing in a home with kids. When we married in 2016, Nathaniel had just finished his PhD, and I was a doctoral student in theology. We had our first son, John, in 2018, and despite my genuine excitement, I must admit it completely upended my world. I remember saying repeatedly to Nathaniel, "My life is over." I could barely think straight, let alone work on a dissertation. The life of the mind that I loved was immediately and almost totally replaced by the very embodied, very particular task of caring for a baby. Nathaniel and I couldn't equitably split the parenting time as we'd envisioned. My son knew what I smelled like. He knew I had the food. He wanted to be with me at all times. When he was sick, no one else would do. I tried to read a nice, easy book while we sat together, some patristic sermons on the Virgin Mary, perfect for a new mom. And John would have none of it. He wanted my full attention. I threw the book across the room in frustration. "Sorry, Mary." But the biggest mistake people make during life with an infant is thinking that this time will last forever. And as John grew up, I found small chunks when I could study and write. Our son George came along in 2021. And when people ask me where the missing dissertation chapter on Origen of Alexandria went, I usually tell them that was George. Still, I made progress, and Nathaniel was very selfless in making this possible, taking the boys on adventures around New York City, where we lived at the time. I wrote and I struggled with impatience and pride. I watched one of my colleagues defend his dissertation, then another. They were both dads. I missed out on important conferences. I watched doors open for Nathaniel that were not open for me because he had already finished his doctorate. It was tough on our marriage, and looking back, I very much see the grace of the sacraments, marriage, reconciliation, and Eucharist in particular, helping us navigate this time. In the summer of 2022, I was ready to defend my dissertation, something I'd looked forward to for 6 years. This was my day. We flew the family to the Midwest. John, 3, stayed with my parents. We brought along a local family friend to babysit George, 10 months old, during the defense. It was bittersweet. Because it was the summer, none of my colleagues were there to support me. But at the end of it, I was Dr. Peters. I possessed the wisdom of this world. And as the committee announced my success and congratulated me, we heard George crying outside the door. He was hungry. And so, while Nathaniel chatted with the beloved members of my committee, George and I escaped to an elevator-sized kitchenette to nurse. No matter, I was able to celebrate with some friends later that evening. Our return flight landed in LaGuardia, about an hour's Uber ride from our house. It had been a tough trip home, but I was satisfied and happy to see what life would offer now that I have my doctorate. I sat in the back seat of the Uber between two car seats, my best buddies, whom I had dedicated my dissertation to. About 20 minutes from home, I looked over at George to my left and noticed that he had pooped and it was overflowing out of his diaper. I stayed calm. I was a mom of two kids, and it was pretty contained. I texted Nathaniel in the front seat. George had a blowout, but I think we should be okay since we're so close to home. I'll just go right in and clean him up while you unload our luggage. Nathaniel, thumbs up. A few minutes later, John, to my right, started making strange noises. I had just enough time to think. Maybe I shouldn't have let him drink an entire can of Minute Maid cranberry juice on the plane. And then to ask, are you okay, buddy? Before he threw up all over himself, his car seat, and the back seat of the Uber. This one I couldn't keep a secret. John began wailing, and George did too. And the last 5 minutes of our drive was absolute chaos between trying to calm the boys down and trying to clean things up. We failed on both counts. We pulled into the driveway with the boys still crying and apologized to our Uber driver, who was very gracious and pulled a giant stack of paper towels from his trunk. Nathaniel and I carried the boys inside and put them straight in the bathtub with their clothes on, still crying. As I rushed to the bathroom with George, I caught a glimpse of a sign Nathaniel had hung in the living room to surprise me upon my return. Congratulations, Dr. Peters. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Not in the Peters house. For all the satisfaction that academic research brings me, for all the joy I've discovered as a teacher, these aspects of life cannot hold a candle to the absolute delight of being a mother. It's incredibly difficult. I understand what the great contemplative Teresa of Avila meant when she said, "Even when you are in the kitchen, our Lord is moving among the pots and pans." I know what Pope Francis means when he says, waste time with your children so they can realize that love is always free. In being a parent, I have been robbed of nothing I deserved, and I have been given everything I did not deserve. I am coming to understand more concretely and thus more deeply what self-emptying love must look like, and thus I am coming to appreciate Christ and his sacrifice in a new and different way. It turns out that what I saw as the freedom and success of a young single person, which for the time it was probably appropriate and developmentally good, was only a simulacrum of the kind of freedom and divine love God asks us to participate in. By the way, I wrote that sentence while listening to stories about Nerf guns. In particular, I think being a mother has helped me understand the tenderness and unconditional nature of divine love. Little children are wonderful in that they have no cynicism or shame. They trust completely that I, their mother, want nothing but the best for them. I would never hurt them or laugh at their pain, would forgive them instantly for any wrong. I can fix every problem and provide for their every need. And during the fleeting years that this childlike trust exists in my children, God has surprised me by inviting me to have this same kind of trust in him. I never realized how guarded and cynical my prayer life was until I was able to contrast it with firsthand experience of the complete trust of a child. This is one of the ways that being a mom has helped me understand the incarnation as a foolishness of speech or a foolishness of preaching. And I'm learning how to rely on God like my children rely on me and to call on him unashamed of the fact that I need him for every good thing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.